This is the Israel Connection on JA Community Radio, broadcasting on 88 FM and streaming over the internet at j-air.com.au. My name is David Schulberg, bringing you another episode of this weekly radio program that provides analysis and insight with important interviews and discussion about Israel. Anyone who listened to my program last week would have heard the first part of an interview with Gidi Grinstein, an Israeli societal entrepreneur who has been involved in peacemaking in the Middle East region since 1995 and is able to offer his astute insights into how we arrived at the events of October the 7th, where we stand now and what current and future negotiators need to know. Grinstein is the co-author of the book Insights, Peacemaking in the Oslo Process 30 Years and Counting, which chronicles the past three decades of the peacemaking process and outlines a path forward. Let's listen now to the second part of my interview with Gidi Grinstein. So for most of the three decades of the Oslo process, significant security collaboration led to countless operational successes in preventing terrorism. Although, as you point out in your book, in a few cases like October 1996, May 2000, and during the early part of the war as of October 2000, Palestinian police used their guns against Israelis. But with the resignation now of the Palestinian Authority government, how do you see that impacting Israel's ability to establish a framework toward a permanent state of solution to the conflict? How will this resignation of the PA government impact what the Oslo Accords have provided? As you've written, the longest lasting cooperation or collaboration created by the Oslo process has been an area of security with the PA, and you maintain in your book that the Oslo process is still alive because the key institutions that it created, primarily the Palestinian Authority in areas A and B and its security and economic relations with Israel, have continued to function. But given this recent announcement, what impact will that have on the visibility or the viability of the Oslo Accords?
There was a resignation of the Palestinian government, but the president, Abu Mazen, can still appoint a new government. The real nightmare scenario for Israel is if Abbas resigns and there is a vacuum and nobody is there to collect the garbage or to take care of security or police. In this situation, Israel may be kind of sucked into direct control of the Palestinians in the West Bank as well. Right now, I understand the resignation of the government, of the Palestinian government led by Mohammad Ashtaya, who I've known for 25 years, as kind of a political maneuver by Abu Mazen in order to ensure that the new government will also report to him. Remember, there is tremendous pressure on Abu Mazen to appoint a government that effectively, external pressure by the Emiratis and by the Saudis and others, to appoint a government that effectively will not report to Abu Mazen. It's a kind of a political maneuver where he allowed the government to resign, and the next government he will appoint, and that government will report to him. This is kind of the logic of what he's trying to do. Also, once there is a reformed Palestinian Authority, then in the eyes of the world, it is legitimately able to move into Gaza and to take control of Gaza. Remember that Hamas controlled Gaza in defiance of the Palestinian Authority. And therefore, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Gaza have been separated since June 2007. So that's almost 17 years. And it was always the vision of Abu Mazen and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank to reunify Gaza and the West Bank. And they see a big opportunity. And they understand that the only way for them to do it is if the world acknowledges that they've gone through some sort of a reform. And that's part of what's going on right now. Abu Mazen said, instead of everybody twisting my arm into firing the government and establishing a new one, I'm kind of doing it, and therefore I'm kind of taking the rug, sweeping the rug from under their feet. I fire the government, I'll establish one, and now you go tell me that this is not a reformed government.
Is it really a proper reform if he simply appoints a few other people to be part of a government? Why wouldn't it be more acceptable if they actually opened the door to democratic elections and chose a government that way?
Okay, so you're now touching on another huge issue, which is who's able to participate in the elections. Remember that we're saying that we, meaning Israel, that Hamas cannot participate in the elections. And only those who accept the Oslo Accords can participate in the election. This is me saying, Gidi. And I believe in the Oslo process. Obviously, it has a lot of faults and a lot of problems. I don't want to kind of ignore that. But fundamentally, I think that the Oslo Accords have been good for Israel. And the proof of that is that all Israeli governments, including this current right-wing government, none of them canceled the Oslo Accords. Okay? So fundamentally speaking, Oslo Accord was in the balance between good and bad. If we are forced to say good or bad, Oslo Accord, in my view, was good. Now, the issue is the Oslo Accords created the Palestinian Authority. And the Palestinian Authority has a government and has a parliament, the Palestinian Legislative Council. And the question is, who can get elected to the PLC, to the Palestinian Legislative Council? According to the Oslo Accord, only parties that accept the Oslo Accords can be elected. But in 2006, the Bush administration, George Bush, with Condoleezza Rice, agreed for Hamas to participate in the elections without accepting the Oslo Accords. And that's the beginning. This is the moment in which the seeds were sown toward the disaster we're living in right now. A lot of Israelis are saying, hey, we want election. But then those same Israelis are unwilling to say, who will participate in these elections? How will we run these elections in Gaza and the West Bank? And so on. So what I want to tell you is that a lot of Israelis would not admit that we actually have an interest in Abu Mazen staying in power the way he is right now. Because the Palestinian system is not ready for elections. And a lot of times, the criticism that there has not been election on the Palestinian side comes from people on the right wing who are using this as criticism without actually saying whether they're willing for these elections to, for example, right now, happen in Gaza. And what do you do if Hamas gets elected? And I'm saying the Palestinians are not ready for elections right now. First of all, we have to have a process of rebuilding. Yes, we have to clean up and we have to upgrade the Palestinian Authority. No doubt, 100% I'm with the program. Okay? But I also believe that only parties that accept the Oslo Accords can participate in the elections. But in order to take this position, it requires the Israeli government to reendorse the Oslo Accords. And guess what? This Israeli government will not reendorse the Oslo Accords. So it's stuck. I hope your listeners and you can understand the conundrum of the current positions of the government. They will not endorse the Oslo Accords, but the only way to have an election is to have a parties that all participating parties are parties that accept the Oslo Accords. So how do you square this circle?
We know it's not easy. That's the serious trouble.
It's not about it's not easy. It's the fact that right now we're in a moment of truth. What happened on October 7 is forcing us to reckoning. And part of the reckoning is we had for a long time, we thought that we could live with Hamas alongside the Palestinian Authority, that it was in our interest that the Palestinian Authority and Hamas are fighting each other. But that means that there cannot be a democratically elected Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Simply cannot. So which of these things are more important for us? The democratic nature of the Palestinian Authority, which requires uniting Gaza and the West Bank, or separating them? And this is just one question. Now, in my view, I have an answer that many people challenge, but at least in my view, it has an element of consistency. In my opinion, an upgraded and reformed Palestinian Authority should be invited to be the governing body of Gaza, to take the control of Gaza from Israel, replace Hamas regime in Gaza, as acknowledging Israel will have to acknowledge. Unfortunately, as you know, in my book, I thought that it's better off for Israel to have Gaza and the West Bank separate. We discussed it earlier, but now after October 7, we have no choice. Gaza and the West Bank are a single territorial unit controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Second, we should say that in the political horizon, there will be a Palestinian state alongside Israel. We don't need to get into the details right now. We just need to acknowledge that. That will then allow us to once we say that there will be a Palestinian state, we can begin to resolve the refugee issue in the West Bank and Gaza, meaning to withdraw UNRWA out of these areas, that there are people who are refugees who are receiving a home in the new reconstruction of Gaza, they let go of the refugee status, because if you're getting a home paid for by precious UAE or Saudi money or American money, you should not be still remain a refugee. And therefore, we're beginning to dilute one of the most concerning sticking issues between us and the Palestinians. UNRWA withdraws, we take the money of UNRWA, we take the responsibilities of UNRWA, we give it to the Palestinian Authority, and we work with the Palestinian Authority to de-radicalize the whole system and eventually prepare for statehood. And at the end of the day, Israel will have to commit for two things, three things. Number one, we will not be able to touch the customs money that we are collecting for the Palestinians. This is Palestinian money, and they will have to get it, because the world will not agree that the world gives the Palestinian Authority money and we take money away because of the customs. I know it may be a little bit of too much detail for your listeners, but some of them have been following the whole issue of customs. Second is that at the end of the day, the permanent borders of Palestine and Israel will be based on UN Security Council Resolution 242. Israel will have to acknowledge that. And if we acknowledge that, basically you create a foundation for the long-term territorial arrangements. There are other things as well, but I think that out of the crisis of October 7, there could be one of the biggest diplomatic and political opportunities in the history of Zionism.
Okay, so we can look forward to this sort of breaking open the whole issue. But what do you make of the calls by most nations around the world now, including Australia, for a two-state solution, advocating for it now as the immediate panacea to the Israel-Palestinian conflict, as part of a parcel to address the war with Hamas, with Israel obviously having no stomach for it following the Hamas atrocity on October the 7th?
So firstly, it's a matter of fact that Israelis don't have the stomach for discussing two-state solution right now. But I think a lot of it has to do because most Israelis have not fully appreciated what it would mean for us to directly control Gaza. We are heading toward direct control of Gaza. 2.3 million Gazans that we will have to basically in one way or another pay for. There will be targets in Gaza. There will be terrorism in Gaza. There will be no Palestinian security like there is in the West Bank. Obviously, in the West Bank, it could be much better, but still we know that there is security collaboration between Israel and the Palestinian Authority that will not exist in Gaza. We will be sitting targets there. It will become a guerrilla warfare sooner or later. We will have to pay for the population. The Arab side is telling us, without a political horizon of a two states for two, based on the principle of two states for two people, they're simply saying to us, you broke it, you fix it. It's yours. You're in control. So I think that sooner or later, many Israelis will begin to understand that without a political horizon, we are stuck in Gaza. And that has many implications. For example, national security, we now know clearly impossible to be bogged down in Gaza and to be challenging Iran in Iran, number one. Okay, this is a radicalizing, you cannot embark on a process of de-radicalizing the Palestinian society when you're occupying Gaza. Because occupation is a radicalizing condition. And if you want to really de-radicalize, you have to do it in collaboration with the Palestinian Authority, with the support of the Emiratis and the Saudis that have been playing a very constructive role in this respect. So there are a lot of things that cannot happen unless we acknowledge the principle of two states for two people. And once we acknowledge the principle of two states for two people, which is what you call the two-state solution, there are other things that can happen. So I think that it's going to be a process, but many more Israelis will come back to appreciate the potential that can emanate from accepting this principle of two states for two people.
And that will probably only happen after there are new elections in Israel and a government is formed to have a mandate for all of that.
And maybe two elections, by the way. Maybe if the next election, let's say, is in June or July, it's too soon. We have to acknowledge that Israel is a society in trauma. And the trauma is ongoing. Every week, there is another revelation about October 7 that just reignites the trauma. We have hostages in Gaza. Horrific situation. So the trauma is ongoing. And because the trauma is ongoing, it's very hard for us to engage with the political horizon that is required for Gaza. So I think it may be a while before the public can begin to come back to a reasonable thinking about the future of our relations with the Palestinians. The message I'm trying to communicate is this. We are on 140 years of a Zionist journey, and we have to keep our eyes on the ball. And our eyes on the ball are a space where the Jewish people can realize its right to self-determination, which is recognized by the family of nations. This is where we're heading. The southern border of the Jewish space on the face of this earth is already recognized by Egypt. It's the border between Israel and Egypt. It's bilaterally agreed and internationally recognized. Same thing with Jordan. Same thing with parts of our border with Lebanon. The most difficult part is the border between us and the Palestinians. And I hope that more and more people will recenter themselves and be able to see past the trauma and to keep moving toward that historical, I would say, milestone for the Jewish people, which is having a space of our own recognized by the family of nations where we realize our right of self-determination.
Well, we've seen how the Jewish people survived the trauma of the Holocaust, so no doubt the capability is there.
100%.
Yeah,
100%. Yeah. 3 years after the Holocaust, we had the State of Israel. 5 years after the 1973 war, we had a peace treaty with Egypt. We are still in the fighting, and we're still months after the trauma of October 7. First of all, we have to continue to have a respectful, as much as possible, public discussion, like we have on your show. I'm sure you have people on your show that have different opinions than I am. And I would hope that your listeners and you really, I know you, I mean, we've been talking, really encourage respectful debate, because it's all for L'shem Shamayim. It's all for the sake of the Jewish people in Israel. We're not politicians here. We are people who are wake up in the morning and think what's best for our society, what's best for our country, what's best for our people. So the first thing is this debate allows you to explore, opens you to ideas, helps you, even if it doesn't change your mind, it helps you be more nuanced in your approach. And ultimately, I hope that reason will prevail. At the end of the day, Zionism, all the big successes of Zionism were tied to major compromises. Okay, when we got the recognition in the Jewish state, it was because we were willing to acknowledge that the Jewish state will not include Transjordan, and it will not include 48% of mandatory Palestine. If the Zionist leadership of 1947 would not be able to acknowledge that, there would not be a state of Israel today. And if we were not willing to withdraw from Sinai, there would not be a peace treaty with Egypt. And honestly, if Netanyahu would not pledge that he would not annex, there would not be the Abraham Accords. So we see that all these big moves are tied with compromises.
Yes, exactly.
And I hope that people will realize that as we move forward.
On a slightly different tack, we see the International Court of Justice began hearings last week on the legality of Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. It's the first time the world's highest court has been asked to give an advisory opinion on this issue, which has been the subject of years of debates and resolutions at the United Nations. Now, this Palestinian lawfare, as I refer to it as, aims to show that Israel has de facto annexed the West Bank, and such a decision is seen by the PLO as an essential stepping stone towards establishing that Israel is an apartheid state, which would lead to its isolation and sanctioning. Do you see this hearing that's going on, which Israel has largely ignored, as having any importance?
Potentially very significant, for a very simple reason. The platform of the existing government of Israel is to annex the Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. This is the platform of the government. This is the goal, the stated goal right now. And also in the political program that Netanyahu published last week, he speaks about timeless control of the Palestinian population in Gaza and the West Bank. He doesn't even mention the vision of a Palestinian state or Palestinian independence or Palestinian self-determination. And I think that by doing that, he's placing us at great vulnerability. We all know that Israel is not an apartheid state. We know that the 20% of the Israeli population, we know this. I'm talking about Arab Israelis. They're members of our society. They are in key positions in government. They're in the economy. All of these things we know. But the world doesn't know that. And the world can easily ignore that as well. The current government is placing us under existential political and diplomatic threat. And I hope that this government will disappear from our political reality faster than the proceedings in the International Court of Justice. I always say that in the words peace process, the word process is more important than peace. There is clearly a Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian contingent that is against Israel and is willing to use diplomatic and military armed force to challenge Israel and to eliminate Israel. This is a fact of life. It's physics. Okay? We know that. But we also know, and therefore the word peace in the sense of happiness and coexistence, that we no longer need to have an army or military service, that's not in the cards. It's not in the menu. And this is why I say that in this conjunction of words, peace process, the word process is more important. We always have to be seen and credibly willing to engage in a political dialogue with the other side. And then it's clear that our control over the Palestinian population is temporary. We're willing to negotiate. We have interest. They have interest. We have needs and they have needs. And in this process, we're exploring them. But the moment the government says, no process, we want to annex, it basically communicates to the world that this is permanent and this is where we become vulnerable. And I think that vulnerability is simply unnecessary.
Yeah, I point out that you say in your book that this is the biggest paradox of all, that if the US government suddenly accepts Netanyahu's position that you've been describing against the Palestinian state ever being established within a two-state solution, what would Netanyahu do then regarding the permanent rights of Palestinians under Israel's control forever?
You hear a lot of Israelis right now who are thinking that the threat is that the U.S. unilaterally recognizes the Palestinian Authority as a state. And I say to them, friends, the bigger threat, much bigger threat, is if the United States actually goes along with Netanyahu and says, you know what, we heard you. From the river to the sea, it's yours. But
that's a possibility if Trump is elected at the end of the year.
You know, because Trump already said one state, two state, you know, whatever they want. Trump said it.
Yes.
Unlike Biden, who's committed to the idea of separation between Israelis and Palestinians, Jews and Arabs, Trump is not committed to this idea. Trump said, whatever works, I don't care. Up to you. I just want to say about Trump. He said that he's willing one state, two state, whatever it can, both are legitimate outcomes for him. But in the Trump plan, he calls for a Palestinian state that covers all of Gaza, is extended into the Negev, okay, and it controls the equivalent of 86% of the West Bank with a capital in the area of Jerusalem. This is in the Trump plan, the plan of President Trump. Trump has been kind of, I don't want to say all over the place, but in two spaces. In one space, he put forward a concrete, detailed plan, more detailed than the Clinton ideas of 2000. Again, some of your listeners may agree or disagree, but it's definitely much more detailed. And then the other side, he says, he's kind of oblivious to the final outcome. It can be either one state or two state, according to him. The bigger nightmare for Israel's national security is the Biden administration or another administration that actually says to Netanyahu, we heard you, it's yours.
Okay. Going forward, you've written that the starting point of any future negotiations will be better compared to 1999 in a few critical ways. And firstly, the minimal positions of any Israeli government, including right-wing ones, will be the Trump plan, which Netanyahu has endorsed. And secondly, the zone of possible agreement on permanent status was determined by the Clinton ideas, And thirdly, the Quartet Roadmap has outlined an alternative diplomatic path in which a Palestinian state is established before permanent status emerges, which you endorse. And finally, the Saudi Peace Initiative endorsed by the Arab League gives Israel invaluable assurances about the benefits of a permanent status deal. But none of these reference points existed for Barak and your team back in 1999. So all of this is now out there, and Israel has to choose, you say, to lead with negotiations or with unilateral actions. So with all these major events that have just occurred recently that we've been discussing in the region that we are witnessing, would you say that we're still in a good position to take from what has happened and move forward positively?
I think that we are looking at a historical opportunity for Zionism in Israel in the following sense. Hamas may be demolished very soon. If the government of Israel is willing to acknowledge, to create this political horizon that we're all talking about, where it will just be willing to say two words, Palestinian state, even if it's 10 years, 20 years down the road, just to acknowledge that this is the outcome of the process, we will have more time, more resources, and more legitimacy to eradicate Hamas. As a member of the Israeli, you could call it peace camp, center left, I'm telling you, Hamas is the enemy of peace. There will not be peace if Hamas is there. Hamas needs to be eliminated, and we have a historic opportunity to do so. But if we're not putting forward a political horizon, there is more and more shackles, more and more limitations on our ability to eliminate Hamas. Now, what is the historical opportunity that we can eliminate Hamas? We can get to a point where the Palestinian political system in Gaza and the West Bank does not include groups that reject Oslo. We are in a world where key Arab countries, UAE, Saudi, Jordan, Egypt, are acknowledging more than ever before Israel's security concerns. We discussed it earlier. In the past, they thought it was lip service. It was a way to eternalize, make permanent the domination over the Palestinians. Now they understand that we have a point and they're willing to work with us on these issues. They're willing to acknowledge the permanent solution will be based on the principle of two nation states for two people, which has been a demand of the Zionist movement for a long time, that the Arab side recognizes Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people. We are this close, I believe, to a concrete work plan to withdraw UNRWA, to begin to resolve the refugee issue. So many things that would be unimaginable October 6th can happen now if we have the diplomatic and the statesmanship, diplomatic leadership and the statesmanship in Israel. And that's the opportunity that I'm seeing. There's obviously more, but this is the opportunity. And I think just in terms of your audience, right, people need to be looking at alternatives. It's not enough to say what's not going to happen. We have to also look at what is possible and what is feasible. And what I'm saying is that the alternative to this diplomatic package that I'm describing is effectively, if Israel is not willing to engage in this process, the outcome will be that we will be in a direct control of the Gaza Strip and the population in Gaza, which is a long-term disaster for Israel. And unfortunately, if this happens and you invite me to the show months down the road, you will see, we will go from bad to worse on these things, unfortunately. So I really hope that at some point, Prime Minister, the government, new government, after election, will begin to embrace the diplomatic process.
You have been listening to the second part of an extensive interview with Gidi Grinstein, who has been actively involved in significant peacemaking efforts in the Israel-Palestine arena since 1995. Listeners can catch up with the first part of my fascinating conversation with Gidi Grinstein, which was centered around his important book, Insights, Peacemaking in the Oslo Process, 30 Years and Counting, by going to the JAIR website and looking for the Israel Connection under programs there, or by visiting the site Omni Studio. I will soon be making a complete podcast of my entire interview with Gidi Grinstein available as a separate podcast. Founder and president of the Center for Peace Communications is Joseph Browde, an expert on the nexus of culture and politics in Arab societies, and an active presence in the region's media and policy debates. A major initiative of the Center for Peace Communications has been the animated series Whispered in Gaza. And in my interview with Joseph Browde a year ago, we spoke about how it depicted Gazans from all walks of life sharing their stories, struggles, and hopes for the future. Now Joseph has embarked on a new project titled Voices from Gaza, which tells us a lot about the people in Gaza today. Welcome back to the Israel Connection, Joseph Browde.
Thanks. Nice to be with you again, Dave.
So there's currently no independent Western media able to report from the embattled enclave of Gaza. Only a handful of Arabic news outlets are now present in the Strip, but their reporters are, in the best case, unable to provide objective coverage of events. And in the worst case, they are complicit with Hamas. Testimonies from real-life Gazans are therefore crucially important at this time to get a more complete picture of the reality on the ground. Your Voices from Gaza project is the continuation of Whispered in Gaza, a series of interviews with Gazans collected by your organization, the Center for Peace Communications, which has compiled short animated video clips with poignant first-hand accounts of Gazan residents' day-to-day life under Hamas's tyranny. Do you want to explain what is the aim of your Voices from Gaza project in greater detail?
Yes, as I've written, in territories in the region where terror militias rule, we believe it's important not only to listen to the voices that hold the megaphone, but also to hear from the majorities who are forced to whisper. There are majorities in all of the territories dominated by Iran in this region, from Yemen and Syria to Lebanon and Gaza, majorities of the population that do not want to be ruled by Iranian proxies or the likes of Hamas and want a different future. But they have found no way to express their aspirations to the international community. While proxies of Hamas like Al Jazeera platform the group's leaders and shills, Hamas enforcers meanwhile intimidate and forcibly repress all dissident voices and have been doing for 17 years. So we decided to try to help Gazans who oppose Hamas break that information monopoly. And we did so by interviewing men and women of all ages from across the Strip, hearing them tell their stories of life under Hamas rule. They described heart-rending stories of a mafia-like system that is generous to the families of its own stalwarts, but really almost traffics in the suffering of the majority of the Gazan population. And we looked for a way to safely elevate these voices. Initially, we did so through the medium of animation. We promised these people that we would not reveal their names or show their faces. And we sought to turn that into a kind of an asset by bringing together a team of animators, illustrators, and musicians to render visually the stories those voices told in a way that would enable you, while not seeing their faces, to, in a sense, inhabit their lives. And that became a series of 25 short animated clips called Whispered in Gaza. We translated it into 7 languages. We released it through media partnerships all over the world, from Latin America and North America to Europe and the Middle East. And in the region, our distribution partner in Arabic was Al Arabiya, which is one of the largest media outlets in the Arabic language. It was something that enabled Arab viewers for the first time ever to hear from Gazans unfiltered. And what they learned from these voices was that Hamas is not a group of heroes, as Al Jazeera strives to portray them, but really more of a drab and brutal authoritarian system, much like the sort of thuggish regimes that so many other Arabs suffer from every day. Opposition to Hamas has manifested in very poignant ways over the years. Notably, in 2019, 1,000 Gazans waged anti-Hamas street demonstrations. In doing so, they not only braved gunfire, prison, and torture, they also exposed their own families to collective punishment for their having shown the courage to call for a different future for Gaza. The fear is real, and it continues to this moment, because as I've said and written in the past, Gazans are not convinced yet that Hamas is about to be unseated. They fear that the outcome of the present war will be similar to that of the four wars that preceded it, which is essentially a brokered ceasefire that ends with Hamas effectively in place.
So I'm hearing some views that because people are believing that Hamas can't be eliminated, that Israel continuing its war in Gaza is really a terrible exercise, because all that will occur is the death of more innocent civilians, people are saying.
The Gazans we're hearing from and platforming are saying is that for the tragedy, the scale of the tragedy that we're seeing today, it's incomparable with the wars that preceded it in Gaza. It will be that much more tragic and utterly unbearable if it ends with Hamas in place. In other words, what they're asking is, what is the point of all of this if it isn't going to lead to the upending of the Hamas government structure?
So let's get into some revelations from your latest project, Voices from Gaza, and perhaps some other accounts that are feeding from other places. You alluded to Hamas, anti-Hamas street protests back in 2019, and a fellow by the name of Mumin al-Natour organized or co-organized these street protests. Do you want to tell us something about his story?
Mumin al-Natour is a lawyer in Gaza, a young man who indeed co-organized the anti-Hamas street demonstrations. Those demonstrations adopted the banner, "We Want to Live, Bidna Naish." It was a repudiation of the Hamas claim that Palestinians love death. So they said, "We want to live." Natour was imprisoned 20 times over the years since then by Hamas, for organizing those demonstrations and attempting to organize new ones. Gazans took to the streets again as recently as July 30th of last year. And now he's among the Palestinians who are trying to find ways to get humanitarian aid to the people who need it without it being siphoned off by Hamas, as there are estimates that as much as 60% of the food aid that is brought in from international donors is taken by Hamas. They use it first to feed their stalwarts, and second, they use it as a form of money, essentially. Bags of aid that are marked not for resale, clearly marked that they're intended to be distributed free to the people who need it, are sold in the markets of Gaza by merchants who are forced to pay for it and then resell it. And that is essentially serving Hamas as a form of financial injection to its war machine. And Mumin is one of the people who understands that and has been trying to find ways to distribute aid directly to the Gazans who need it.
His organization is called the Palestinian Youth for Development, I understand.
Yes.
Another case is the one of Mohammed Mushtaha, a mosque preacher in the Gaza City neighborhood of Shejaiya. Tell us his story, please, Joseph.
And this is one of the many pieces and videos as well that came out through the Free Press, our distribution partner in the United States for the new series Voices from Gaza. Mohammed Mushtaha is a mosque preacher who has been a mosque preacher for many years in Shujaiya, very well liked, and he is not a Hamas stalwart. Generally, the people in the religious establishment who are not ideologues of Hamas, you never hear about them outside of Gaza, because they don't make those kinds of blood-curdling statements that find their way in translation into the outside world through the likes of Memory, right? They simply keep their heads down. But in this instance, Mushtaha was ordered by Hamas to give a pro-Hamas sermon to an audience of several thousand Gazans who were sheltering in a school. And he refused to do it. And for refusing to do so, he was abducted by Hamas, and his family feared that he would be killed. Now, we were in touch with his son and talked about the options that they had, and they made the agonizing choice, and it's impossible to know what to do really in situations like this, but their calculation was that it would be better to tell his story to the world than to be silent and simply hope that he would be freed. This rather harrowing account by his son of his own father's abduction was published in the Free Press. It led to his release. 2 days after the piece was published, Hamas let the cleric go. I think that the story is important because it points to the existence of a cadre, some subset of religious leaders in Gaza who differ with Hamas, at least in some key ways, and who would be in a position to argue differently about what Islam brings to bear in questions of the future of Gaza. And so we consider it important to give a voice, give a platform to people like that who take this sort of brave stand.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I shared with you another article, which was in Haaretz, by a Gazan who called himself Abdullah to protect himself. He's anti-Hamas, but what astounded me in that particular instance was the comments that were there that slammed this guy as just being another mouthpiece for pro-Israel propaganda. What do you make of this account that was published by Haaretz, which of course wouldn't normally put stuff out that is considered to be too right-wing?
Well, what we find when we put these voices up, the likes of the kind of voice that you're describing, is that it's inconvenient to people both on the far left and the far right. It doesn't fit their narrative. And their first instinct when they hear a voice that doesn't conform to their narrative, in the past, when we had a more civil culture of discourse in much of the world, when we heard something that didn't fit our narrative, we would grapple with it. We would debate it, engage it, etc. But today, people's instinct is to say, oh, that must be a lie because it's inconsistent with what I believe. So in our case, we've seen people on the far left respond to the many voices within Gaza that oppose Hamas by claiming that that's impossible. These couldn't really be Gazans. Surely all Gazans agree with Hamas. How could anyone in Gaza express or believe something other than what Hamas says without being some kind of a paid Israeli agent? Even though opinion polling, and I know you'd like to get into that later, has consistently shown majorities of Gaza opposed to Hamas governing their territory. We've also seen objections on the far right to this testimony because it doesn't conform to their claims that, in their words, there are no innocent people in Gaza. In other words, there's a school of thought that all Gazans are in some ways complicit with Hamas. That's patently false. And it's certainly unhelpful to anyone who aspires to see decent self-rule in Gaza in the future. Undoubtedly, that type of self-rule will hinge on identifying and empowering Gazan elements that oppose Hamas. And yet these extreme voices don't want to hear or see any venture that humanizes Palestinians in Gaza who want a different future.
One article that I came across, Joseph, which really is very revealing, was one coming from a Syrian journalist, Manar al-Sharif, who told Times of Israel how life under Hamas is like being under ISIS and that the majority of Gazans don't back this terror group. Would you tell us a little bit about what happened with her? She moved to Gaza, apparently, to study there, but things didn't quite work out for her.
Yes, Manar Sharif is one of the very brave young people who came together in what they called the Gaza Youth Committees several years ago to create educational projects designed to foster resiliency and so on among Gazan youth. And among the things that they did was to organize a series of Zoom encounters with Israeli peace activists. And they did this publicly. and Manar and several others who were among the organizers of this on the Gazan side were jailed by Hamas for having so much as spoken with Israeli civilians. They were eventually released, and Manar now lives safely outside Gaza, enabling her to be among the voices that shines a light on all of this.
One story that I find absolutely extraordinary, and I've watched the video account that's produced by Prague University CEO Marissa Streit. This is the story of Dor Shachar, who changed his name to that. He warns the world in no uncertain terms about the evil of Hamas. He grew up in Gaza, suffered a horrific childhood. If you watch the video, he talks about standing in the street when he was a seven-year-old boy, seeing heads rolling down the street from people who must have been decapitated at the time of the conflict between Fatah and Hamas. And he has personal experiences in a Palestinian jail before moving to Israel and converting to Judaism. His harrowing account is absolutely amazing, giving a glimpse into the reality of what life is like for people in Gaza. Do you know any more about Dor Shachar? He's been in Israel now for a little while. He is not a new story necessarily.
Yes, I've followed that story and seen the interview you're referring to. While, of course, most Gazans don't, their life path doesn't follow his, you know, to the extent that you described. But within Gaza, there are many who remain there and see themselves as bound inextricably to that land, and who identify as Palestinians, as Muslims, and so on, and very proud to be so, and may also be seriously at odds with Israel, yet oppose Hamas's brand of what it calls resistance because it is so self-destructive, because it doesn't attain Palestinian national aspirations. It's about starting wars one can't win while hiding in bunkers, leaving civilians to suffer the casualties, and stealing money and food intended from the outside world to go to ordinary Gazans, but instead that really pads the pockets of Hamas leaders and their families who live in opulence in Qatar and Turkey while the population suffers. That's what the majority of Gazans oppose. And those are the kinds of people we're primarily focused on reaching and engaging.
And just one other thing, one other little anecdote from that account of Dor Shachar. When he grew up, his father said that the Israelis have got three legs. They're very evil people. Not, he didn't talk about horns for some reason. He talked about having three legs. He, at the time when it was easy to go into Israel to work, managed to go there, and he just walked behind some Israelis just to see what really was the situation. And of course, he found out that Israelis are just like anybody else, bearing two legs. What such an amazing lie that his father put on his own son.
Indeed, the dehumanization of the other is, of course, a mainstay of messaging in Gazan media, mosques, and schools, as engineered by Hamas over this past generation. The impact of that on the cultural sensibilities of the Strip has been profound. It's something that won't be easily addressed. It will take tremendous time and proactive effort to bring a sense of decency within the schools and the mosques and the public communications platforms of Gaza. Not to replace one form of brainwashing with another per se, but simply to tell the truth, to enable Gazans to communicate with their Israeli neighbors and with the outside world, and of course to enable Gazans to think for themselves, to foster critical thinking, enabling them to question what they are being told by their leaders and by the sources of information that surround them.
You've already intimated that you're in cooperation with Bari Weiss's mouthpiece, The Free Press, with regards to your Voices from Gaza project. Do you want to tell us how that cooperation is working with Bari Weiss?
The Free Press, Bari Weiss's publication, is taking off really here in the United States. And it was after October 7th that we were in touch with them about the idea of joining hands to bring out new testimony from Gazans amid the unfolding war that would enable Gazans to describe their own predicament to an international audience. So we had the network that we had developed, the human network within Gaza, honed through the Whispered in Gaza project. And the Free Press has a wonderful distribution platform and is very effective in getting the message out on social media and legacy media. And we've worked together in what is effectively a co-production called Voices from Gaza that has to date released 16 pieces of testimony from Gazans post October 7th.
You say that the testimony of civilians in Gaza contradicts both the extreme left perception that the terror group's murderous resistance is an expression of the will of the Palestinian people and the idea held by some on the far right that there are no innocent people in Gaza and everyone is affiliated in one way or another with the terror group. And nonetheless, polls administered by the renowned pollster Khalil Shikaki, professor of political science and director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah, apparently show a rise in support for Hamas following the October the 7th atrocity. Furthermore, despite the ensuing devastation, 57% of respondents in Gaza and 82% in the West Bank believe Hamas was correct in launching the October attack, the poll indicated. A large majority believed Hamas's claims that it acted to defend a major Islamic shrine in Jerusalem against Jewish extremists and win the release of Palestinian prisoners. Only 10% said that they believed Hamas has committed war crimes, with a large majority saying that they did not see videos showing the militants committing any atrocities. What do you make of these depressing numbers, Joseph?
Well, to begin with, the same polling has shown nearly 70% of Gazans told that they do not feel free to express their actual opinions. So in an environment where the majority of Gazans have fear about even responding to an opinion poll, the fact that 10% of respondents said that they believe that Hamas was perpetrating war crimes is a quite significant number, and it reflects a larger number that would have been more reluctant to say something like that to a pollster over the phone. There are seemingly contradictory data points in these polls, and now I'm talking not only about the recent ones, but also ones going back a long way, that are actually quite easy to reconcile when you look at the minutiae of the questions and the data. Majorities of Gazans consistently say that they oppose Hamas as a governing actor in Gaza. When they do that, they're talking about the corruption, the dictatorial sort of tyrannical style of governance, and the failure of the Hamas governing structure to deliver on their basic needs. So that is a solid majority that we've seen before and after October 7th. Of Gazan opposition to Hamas as a governing actor. Now, some people might confuse that to think that, oh, that somehow means that since they're anti-Hamas, they're pro-Israel or something like that. By no means, it's of course entirely possible to be anti-Hamas and anti-Israel at the same time. And so a great many Gazans, as is reflected in these polls, believe in the idea of resistance in the abstract, yet oppose Hamas's brand of resistance for being essentially self-destructive. Another kernel of truth in what you relayed is the vast disparity between public opinion in the West Bank and public opinion in Gaza. In sum, both populations are very unhappy with their own rulers. So what you find in Gaza is that people oppose Hamas as a governing actor and would rather be ruled by the Palestinian Authority. And what you find in the West Bank is they oppose the PA as a governing actor and would rather be ruled by Hamas. That is the nature of the situation there. And in some ways mirrors the trend in much of the region of populations that are unhappy with their rulers for a range of recurring reasons that have to do with simply failure to govern decently, justly, and fairly.
I'm hoping that something like Voices from Gaza, this is one of the reasons that we're speaking, to give people greater realization of the situation, and that your efforts reach a kind of crescendo, which will see us getting some hope that Hamas's hateful ideology won't actually survive this current war.
Well, I think that it's possible to defeat Hamas, and you've noted that it's not only about defeating them militarily, it's about defeating them as a military force, as a governing actor, and as an ideology. It's possible to achieve one or two, but not three, not all three of those goals. I think that the first goal is, while difficult, is the easiest. The second goal, ending Hamas as a governing actor, is also possible within the medium term. And it's a longer term struggle to defeat Hamas ideologically. It's a generational struggle. And that's being optimistic, because if it took a generation, if Hamas had the whole of Gaza in its clutches for a generation, it would be a similarly sustained effort that would be required to reorient all of these same institutions that have been inculcating Hamas ideals for all these years, to get them to teach deep moderation, tolerance, coexistence, critical thinking, etc. That is not an easy thing to do, but ultimately it is the only true safeguard against a resurgence of Hamas in one form or another over time.
You have been listening to a slightly reduced version of an interview with founder and president of the Center for Peace Communications, Joseph Browder, who has been instrumental in the project Voices from Gaza, which is an extension of Whispered in Gaza, a series of interviews with Gazans collected and compiled into short animated video clips with poignant first-hand accounts of Gazan residents' day-to-day life under Hamas tyranny. The interview with Joseph Browder that you heard today was truncated a little, but I will be making the full interview with him available shortly on the JA website and via OmniStudio. Moreover, I'm intending to produce a video version of the interview with Joseph Browder, interspersed with clips from some of the Gazans who have been brave enough to speak out against Hamas on this program's YouTube channel. I'll advise listeners when that is ready for viewing. Until next week, it's goodbye from the Israel Connection.